The episode you're about to hear is supported by the Belfast Buildings Trust and made possible by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. Really hope that you enjoy. When people think about Northern Ireland and the Second World War, they often think about soldiers, shipbuilding, and the Belfast Blitz. But there's another incredible story from someone who originally didn't call Belfast her home. One that often gets forgotten, and one that's more important than ever to keep on telling today.
She, all her life, had the tattoo on her arm from the Auschwitz number. It was always there.
She was touched by evil, but it was her dance that saved her life on more than one occasion.
Anyone could come to Helen's classes, and if they showed an interest, she would work with you. I mean, Helen could make anyone dance, really.
She facilitates, through that generosity, a cultural outpouring that really is awe-inspiring.
In this week's episode, join us as we travel through the pages of local and global history to discover how one woman from Prague survived the horrors of the Holocaust, brought modern dance to Northern Ireland, and inspired a generation of young people during the Troubles. My name is Matthew Thompson, and these are the streets where they lived.
Belfast is all about stories. Any place is all about stories.
Because without those people, we wouldn't be here today. You walk in the footsteps of your predecessors.
But the work ethic, I mean, that would come from his early days in Belfast, I would think.
So he deserves to be remembered for the great.
Yeah, well, absolutely. They're awful legends.
Welcome to The Streets Where They Lived, a six-part podcast series where we'll be diving deep into the incredible heritage of Belfast through the stories of historic men and women and the buildings they once called home. Episode 5 is all about Helen Lewis, the dancing Holocaust survivor. Really hope that you enjoy.
Many years later, she came over to Baltimore to be with us, and we took her to the Holocaust Museum in DC. And that was a remarkable experience, just to be with her and to go into one of the cattle cars that they transported to Auschwitz, to be there to see that. And she would say, God, I was in that, you know. There's a huge wall of videos, you know, video shots, all, you know, like a gallery. And she came on a photograph of an arm. Again, she said, God, she was. Now, she knew it was a she because the nails were painted. And she said, God, she was in my transport. The number was very, very close to Helen's number. And when we came back from that, we went out to have something to eat. And that night, she talked as if the floodgates were opened. We heard stories that we never heard before or since. She talked until about, I think it was 4 or 5 in the morning before we went to bed. She talked and talked, and it was just totally amazing.
Like many Holocaust survivors, Helen didn't speak publicly about her experiences until later on in life, when she published her memoir, A Time to Speak. But as part of this series, we wanted to find out how much the people closest to Helen knew, and were delighted to have the opportunity to speak with her youngest son, Robin.
I'm the younger son. My elder brother Michael's 5 years older than me. I'm told that there was a sit-down with him, a time when Mum and Dad felt he needs to know something. And apparently he was about 9 or 10 when that happened. I don't remember that ever happening with me. My memory is I always knew that she had been in a camp of some kind, as a prisoner of some kind. Mm. She, all her life, had the tattoo on her arm from the Auschwitz number. I can't remember ever noticing that or thinking anything about it. It was always there. I think one thing about my parents that was remarkable was the past was always there to be talked about if something came up or we were watching something on TV or if we asked a question. There was never a box of don't ask that, it's too difficult, it's too upsetting.
He pointed to a building in a short distance and he said, what do you see? And I said, smoke, lots of smoke. And he said, what do you think? He said, do you see smoke comes from? I said, I have no idea. It smells peculiar. It's a very strong smell here. And this is how he explained to me. And this from him, I heard the first time the word gas chambers.
One of the things that my mum brought with her from her past was a absolute horror of labelling people. So the habit of labelling or categorising people by community or religion or whatever was one that she hated and had seen reach its worst side. She and my dad, of course, had the advantage of being outsiders. They knew perfectly well, the moment they opened their mouths and spoke with noticeable foreign accents, they were not within the community categories of Northern Ireland, and in a way that gave them opening into anywhere.
This is just one that's kind of popped in my head. Was there ever any thought or conversation about having her tattoo removed?
No. And I have a feeling I did ask that question, and I think the answer was, why should I? I've done nothing wrong. If other people see it and are embarrassed by it, that is the problem of other people.
People had no idea what had gone on in Europe during the war, and there were sort of two different groups. When if you started saying anything, one group would say, that's behind us, it's in the past, we have to put it aside and forget about it, let's leave it alone. And the other group would say, oh please don't talk, it's so awful, I can't bear it, I will faint if I hear more. I wouldn't be able to sleep all night. Whereupon I said cruelly, so what? What's a sleepless night?
We always knew, I mean, that it was there. Helen was from Czechoslovakia. Helen had been, we knew vaguely the background, but she did not talk about it, because strangely enough at that time, Britain seemed to be very sheltered from it all. People didn't want to know. It's a strange thing, but they really didn't want to know.
That's Joe McCready, who we heard from earlier, a close friend of Helen's, and the actor who played her on stage in the play written by legendary playwright Sam McCready, who was also Joan's husband.
How it came about eventually that we got much more of the story was that Sam and Helen and I were sitting and chatting, and Helen didn't seem, she seemed, you know, a little distressed that evening. And that was the occasion, it's in the book, where a young man, youngster, you know, maybe even on a summer job, you know, was filling her petrol, and her arm was on the window. It was summertime, it was hot, you know, and her arm was on the window. And the young man totally innocently said to her, oh, what a good idea, you've got your telephone number on your arm. It was in fact her Auschwitz number, which is just, they were all, was just below the cleft of the elbow, you know, so he could see it. And for some reason that just had shaken her up so much that she started talking to us.
Orton had progressed and the living conditions and the climatic conditions became worse and worse. We were working outdoors so many hours a day, and it became almost intolerable to continue in these conditions with our exhaustion and our hunger having taken its toll. Every fortnight, the lorry arrived and took those away who were not capable anymore. And I felt very clearly that I had reached a point again where my life was in imminent danger because I only pretended to work. I sort of lifted the spade and tried to pretend I was working. And one of these awful days when I was doing that, I suddenly heard a voice behind me. And the voice said, "You are ready for Stutthof." As I turned around, it was the guard, our guard, SS guard, and he was writing down my number into his notebook. So I knew what it meant. It was a final judgment.
How did the book come about, or what was the desire to really put down explicitly and in long form the details of what your mum went through?
I think, and I'm slightly guessing, I think she started writing it in about 1986. Now, she had always had episodes that she talked about, or memories, or random memories. And I'm sure lots of people said, "You ought to write this down one day." In 1986, two things happened in her life. One was that she turned 70, and I think it might have hit her for the first time. You know, lots of people call that the start of old age. And 4 months after she turned 70, her first grandchild, Daniel, was born. And I think she suddenly realized, well, there's another generation, and they may need to know something about where their family came from. And my guess, and it really is a guess, is that those were the two things that started her writing episodes. She didn't sit down to write a book. She wrote episodes of random memories. And it was partly through Michael Longley's support. He was a friend and neighbour. And partly through Blackstaff's support that got turned into Time to Speak.
On that same evening, when we were standing at roll call, and there was a younger Hungarian girl standing beside me, and as so often the roll call took hours and hours and hours, and she whispered to me and said, "God in heaven, if this goes on, we won't have time to rehearse." Rehearse? It was a word from the past. I didn't know it still existed. I said, "What on earth are you rehearsing?" And she said, "Don't you know, the woman commandant has ordered a Christmas entertainment, and we are rehearsing for that." About 2 days later, by sheer chance, I found myself beside her again. And just I said, "Well, how are your rehearsals going, you know, incredulous?" And she said, "Oh, it's going very well. You're doing drama and music and singing and reciting. The only terrible problem we have is with dance. It's in a terrible state." I said, what do you dance?" And she started softly whistling a tune. And I said, "Oh, really? The waltz from Coppelia?" She looked at me and she said, "How do you know? If you immediately recognize a waltz from Coppelia, you must know something about dance." And I said, "I did, in another life."
Why do you think the book really resonated with people at the time and continues to resonate? Like, you know, I was born in 95, never met your mum, no idea of that kind of world or even the Belfast that she was a part of. But here I am reading this book and I'm just utterly gripped by it.
I think at the time, I think it created a bit of a shockwave in Northern Ireland among people who knew her. There were many, many friends who read it, and they'd known in general terms she had suffered bad times during the war. I think actually reading the narrative of what happened and what happened to her and the detail that she gives and the loss of her mother and her husband, I think that really shocked people. I think there was a wider sense of here is somebody who lives here in this community in Belfast in Northern Ireland and has brought with her, has carried all this weight of history. I think there's a third thing, and my brother and I have disagreed about this, which is I think the absence of bitterness. I think there's something in the book which is I have been through these terrible things and I have lived through them and I'm writing about them now calmly. There's even a bit of serenity about bits of the book. I think that touched a feeling in Northern Ireland at the time about how do you live with the sense of the wrongdoing of the past.
The next evening, again, I was on Sunday, the lights went up, Achtung, and somebody walked in from one of the things, pointed at me, said, get dressed, get up, get dressed, and immediately to rehearsal. Well, to be deprived even of half an hour of sleep was half an hour nearer to death. It was so precious. I was very unhappy, but however, I had to go. I walked into that hall and it was warm and the lights were on. And then, of course, they started shouting, dance for us, you dance for us. How could I dance? I could hardly stand upright. I was so tired, so exhausted, so weak. There was a wonderful accordion player there, and she started playing some South American music. I took off my shoes, and God knows, I started dancing, just improvising for them and for myself. And this miracle took place. For the few moments, my tiredness, my exhaustion, my hopelessness left me, and I became involved in my old love again, and I danced with them. Next morning, we stood at roll call, as always, in the icy cold and in the darkness, and there was a hated voice on the loudspeaker proclaiming the orders for the day. And suddenly, that voice spoke my name, not my number, my name. And it said, the woman commandant, the Oberaufseherin, has given orders that the dancer from last night will from now on be exempt of outdoor work. She can stay indoors, rest during the day, but she will have to rehearse with the others in the evening. She's also to get an extra soup a day.
One of my favourite parts in the book is just at the very end where she talks about how, you know, she had recurring nightmares even after moving to Belfast, but that they stopped after the birth of her kids. And I just thought that that was a really interesting kind of statement of how starting a family and bringing new life into the world was something of a healing sort of process for her.
Do you know, Matthew, you are the first person who has said that.
Wow.
And it's an extraordinarily sensitive piece of reading. But she felt that the birth of a first child in this new home was a fresh start. And she couldn't put any other explanation on why this recurrent nightmare stopped when she became a mother and all of those things to do with new life in a new place. What she responded to, and what she's always said about Belfast, was she found the warmest people in the world, and as time went on, particularly when times got bad in Northern Ireland, that was something that she stuck to and believed very firmly. Whatever else is happening, these are the warmest, most decent people in the world, and this is my home.
It takes a while to stop looking over your shoulder, the feelings of paranoia that I'm sure many people experience. Therefore, initially, you're suspicious. Why are people smiling at me? What do they want from me? When is it going to turn around and bite me? But afterwards, you say to yourself, wow, these people really are friendly. And you feel yourself in a comfortable surround. So there's a sort of general feeling of relief, of being light, and therefore the desire to want to contribute back.
One of Helen's greatest contributions was bringing modern dance to Northern Ireland, an achievement that has been recognised by a blue plaque on the Crescent Arts Centre, where she often taught classes. David Singer was the rabbi of the Jewish community when the plaque was unveiled and was able to tell us more about that event, where he was asked to say a few words.
It was preceded by a lot of homework. Because I'd never met Helen, I began to first of all, ask people to tell me something about her. And so many people said to me, well, haven't you read her book? So, no, I hadn't read her book. And I was then offered so many copies of her book from people from the community. And I began to get the feeling of, look, this isn't a story that I was totally unfamiliar with. Parents of friends of mine who had gone through experiences of Auschwitz or other places as well. What was very, very new to me was her expression in the book of those very personal experiences, and how she built from the embers of a destroyed life, how she built, or rather rebuilt, her whole life, as it were, yet again. And being familiar with Jewish writings, the moment that I was told that her biggest contribution to Belfast and life in Northern Ireland was her dance centre. So therefore, that's what came to my mind, this particular quotation that I found of, just as I dance towards you, but cannot touch you, referring to the moon, it is distant from us, so we can dance towards this light. It's impossible to touch it. So the prayer is, so that may none of my enemies be able to touch me for evil. Mm. She was touched by evil, but it was her dance that saved her life on more than one occasion. But certainly this was a huge contribution.
There was a huge crowd there because Helen was very popular. You know, very, very popular. And there were a lot of her past pupils were there, a lot of people who knew her, a lot of her friends, a lot of colleagues. And her two sons, Robin and Michael, were there for that unveiling, as was the chief rabbi, who said prayers for them. Then everybody came in, and there's a performance space, and that's where my dancers performed the dance.
That's Brenda McKee, a close friend of Helen's and a fellow member of the Belfast Modern Dance Group, who choreographed a special performance in her memory at the unveiling of the blue plaque.
I felt a huge responsibility in that choreography because I wanted to show something about Helen, what she was like, and also what she had left behind, that we were still dancing, that she had left an enormous gift to us that was still being used and hopefully will still be used in the future.
Why were you so keen to have the plaque on the Crescent? Why was that something that you pushed for rather than the residents?
She had close ties with the Crescent in the sense that she liked the people who were running. And of course, in the Crescent, they were always very, very friendly. And the fact that there was a Helen Lewis studio there, you know, and it seemed to just complete the circle to have that plaque up outside where people could see that she had been there, that she had taught, and that there was a studio there called after her. And that's why I felt there was such a close connection. And of course, it's where I continued to teach there. And hopefully people coming after me will, you know, do the same.
The Crescent Arts Centre stands today as a reminder of Helen's impact on Belfast, and is one of the only physical connections to her story that we have left. To find out more about the building itself, we caught up with Marcus Patton from the Belfast Buildings Trust, who was also able to tell us the role buildings play today in helping us remember the past.
There was actually an earlier building on the site in the 1830s. It shows up on the old Ordnance Survey map. Don't know what that looked like, but it was a reasonably big platform, so it's probably a farmhouse. That was pulled down around 1850, And the area around that area is generally pretty much countryside, south of the city centre, and Donegal Square would have been the edge of the city at that stage.
Wow.
And then the university was built in the 1850, and that immediately brought a lot of development out towards the university. Right beside the Crescent, there are two streets called Upper and Lower Crescent, which are unusual in Belfast. They're rendered or plastered buildings with big columns in front of them, what they call neoclassical style. And it's almost unique in Belfast, having that appearance and being very formal buildings. Upper Crescent is a crescent. Lower Crescent actually is a straight street, despite the name, and that's where the school is at the end of that. I say the school because in 1870, the Crescent Centre building was built as a school by a lady called Margaret Ayres. And it was intended to be a high-class grammar school for girls. And in the 1885, the Queen Victoria's Jubilee, the school became Victoria College, which was there then until the 1980s. So it was built as a school, and unlike the houses, it was built in stone. So it matches the church buildings in the area, which are also stone, indicating that it's an institutional building rather than a domestic one.
I'm looking here at a painting that you did of Crescent. One of the many hats that you wear is also as an artist. What did you learn from having a closer inspection of that building by painting it? You know, because it's a building that we've walked past, oh goodness, countless times in our lives in Belfast. Was there anything that kind of struck you whenever you were sitting down to do that piece?
Sketching buildings or drawing buildings, you always do notice something. If nothing else, you notice the way buildings are used and the kind of activity going on around it. Maybe just in this case, it just got me looking more closely at the detail of the stonework, for instance. It's what they call rock-fronted stonework. In other words, the stones aren't smoothly faced. They look a bit like faced rocks. It's scrabble stone, which is, you know, from the quarry down near Newton Ards. Mm. But it's a very, very attractive building and very much a landmark in the area.
And are you aware of any kind of evolutions that the building we know today has gone through? You know, was there many changes from school into art centre?
I think most of the work that was done was really renovation simply. Well, new services is obviously the main thing that's done in these sort of jobs. But a school and an art centre require very much the same kind of facilities. The main change I think they had to make was to add on the dance studio at the railway side of the building, which is the bit that's named after Helen Lewis, because that's where she would have worked with dance.
A possibility could have been to have brought the building down and built a new centre. Talk to me about some of the many drawbacks to that approach.
Well, building a new building is very expensive. If you have a building that's on the site which you can use, it makes utter sense to make use of it. Not only, as I say, because it's a well-built building and has all these advantages of memory and so on with it, but simply physically it's there and it makes sense to use it. It has identity, which a new building doesn't have.
There's another interesting thread because, of course, the Crescent Arts Centre plays a major role in educating women in Belfast. And again, the generations of creative women, whether that's been in dance or drama or creative writing, that have come and emanated from that building are pretty significant. And there are lots of people now working on telling these stories around Belfast, the mark that women have left on this city, which is pretty phenomenal.
That's Fionnuala J. O'Boyle, the founder of the Belfast Buildings Trust, a charity founded in 1996 to regenerate Belfast's landmark buildings and to ensure the city's authentic heritage is made relevant for people like you and me today.
I was privileged to meet Helen Lewis at the very beginning of my career when, as an elderly woman, she was still choreographing, creating and teaching dance. And here is this remarkable woman who has made Belfast her home. And despite everything that she has been through, responds with incredible generosity. And I think there is something about that endurance that sort of says, if I am not going to go under, if I am going to be truly resilient, then what I must do is respond with generosity. And she facilitates, through that generosity, a cultural outpouring that really is awe-inspiring.
After speaking with Fionnuala, I couldn't agree more that Helen's story is awe-inspiring. But I also couldn't help shift the reality that so few young people in Belfast know about her today, even though for many of us, her story is hidden in plain sight. To talk a bit more about this, I called up Rachel Brady from the Linenhall Library, who by chance actually takes dance classes in the Crescent Arts Centre itself. Like, when did you first hear of or come across Helen Lewis? Because I'll be honest, she's not someone that I knew very much about whatsoever. I think maybe I used to work for Deliveroo, so I was cycling around the city all the time. And I think I remember cycling past the Crescent at one point and like looking up and being like, Helen Lewis, who on earth is that?
I totally hang my head in shame because I attend the dance class in the Crescent Arts Centre. With Chi Xiong Soon, which is by way a byproduct of Helen Lewis.
Wow.
And we actually dance in the Helen Lewis Dance Studio in the Crescent. So unknown to me, I had been around this woman for that long and had never taken any notice of her name or who she was or what it all meant. Really, it was Linenhall. I mean, I kind of took notice one time we were in the studio and I thought, oh, yes, this woman, she's got a big plaque. I wonder if we have anything in our archives about her. So I went off and I found her book, The Time to Speak, and that really explains her whole life story and how she came to be in Belfast, and obviously all of the things that she went through during World War II and setting up her modern dance group in Belfast. Before that, whenever she was a young girl, I think she attended a class at the age of 6 in Czechoslovakia, where she was growing up, and she attended one class with a teacher and then came home and proclaimed to her family that she was going to be a dancer one day.
Unreal.
And I think that because her family was quite interested in the arts, you know, she talks about her parents being very talented in musical instruments and her father was very interested in theatre. She had that start in life. So once she came to Belfast, she got a letter from a family friend who had came to here to escape, obviously, the war that was happening at that time. And so she married her then husband, Harry Lewis. Her first husband had died in one of the concentration camps. And Harry Lewis actually found her name on a list, a Red Cross list, a survivors list in 1947. So they got married and came back to Belfast. And she really became involved in a lot of different things that were happening at that time. She did a lot of work in Belfast with children who were affected by the Troubles. And she visited and spoke to prisoners in the maze about her experiences during the war, obviously, and having to her survival, basically. So she was very active, even outside of dance. Her greatest quote that actually is wrote on the Helen Lewis studio wall tells you a little bit about her story, and it is, there are many people who have given their lives to dancing, but there are not too many who can truthfully say that dancing saved their lives.
How has your own curiosity into Helen, and like you said, you've gone, you've watched the YouTube videos, you went through the archives. Has it changed your Friday night dance class in any way?
It really has. I mean, for me, I was going and being with the people that I was with in the room and not knowing that there was this bigger story in existence. So you can see that all of these links kind of lead back through the same story. And I think without that, really, if we think about the dance companies that are in existence now in Belfast, likes of Maiden Voyage Dance Company, Dance Unlimited, Echo Echo Dance Theatre Company, and others, you know, would they really have that opportunity without the likes of Helen Lewis coming over and, you know, making the impact that she did and making art and dance take those kind of, I suppose, leaps into new areas that they might not have? I mean, they always say that she was kind of a trailblazer and a great influencer in introducing modern dance. And without her, maybe it would have taken a lot longer for it to reach us.
Another person whose life was directly impacted by Helen's work is Philip Johnson, a dancing trailblazer in his own right, who not only has gone on to perform and teach all over the world, but was also a student and close friend of Helen's, who danced in her company on many occasions.
I was introduced to modern dance through a primary school teacher, Jim Hawkins. That really changed my life. But later on, I discovered that Jim's girlfriend was dancing with Helen. So Jim was seeing a lot of Helen's work, and that's where he then introduced it into the school curriculum. So I had, in a sense, I knew of Helen's work, and I was dancing in this modern dance form, but I didn't know it was Helen. I was only 11 years old. And it wasn't until I think I was around 16 that I went to a performance. I had a friend who also danced with her company, and I was taken to see a performance. That's when I met Helen. And then sometime after that, I started taking classes with her. And that was the beginning.
So talk to me a little bit about why did coming into contact with modern dance at the age of 11, you said it changed your life. Could you tell us why?
Yes, because it introduced me to a world that I didn't know existed. And my teacher, for those who were not interested in this, he literally said, there's a ball, go and kick it around in the playground.
Wow.
It was goodbye to you. And those of us who were interested would stay. We'd have, you know, a couple of hours a week, different times doing this. And it was just a magical world for me. It really was an extraordinary place to hear this music, to move and to, you know, he gave certain exercises we would do. And, you know, it was a class, it was a dance class, and but it always ended up with something creative, which again is what Helen did. You know, you never took just a dance class with Helen. There was something always, a certain part of the class where you were creating and making work. I remember when I was leaving here in 1978, I was interviewed by Gloria Honeyford in a BBC morning radio program. And she asked me what my future plans were. Well, of course, at that age, what do you know? Probably full of high ambitions. And I said, once I've had my training, I'm returning to Northern Ireland and I want to have a dance company.
Mm.
But of course, once I had my training in London, I was offered a job. And Belfast, Northern Ireland, this side of the IRC, just really faded into the background, apart from family and Helen and friends. And so in 2019, I was at the Crescent Arts Centre for a wonderful conference, a dance conference. And I met the new CEO of the Crescent, Sophie Hales. And we had this lovely conversation. And I said to her, you know, about the possibility of working with young people here in Northern Ireland. And that is an ongoing conversation. And I suppose had it not been for present circumstances with COVID, that might have been a little further along the way. So I would really love to see that happen. And certainly would feel that, as you know, the Helen Lewis studio is there. And that would be continuing certainly Helen's legacy there.
Helen's life is a powerful example for us today and proves that despite the difficulties we face in our own lives, each of us has the opportunity to do something great for our city and the people who call it home. But stories are only powerful if they continue to be told. And part of our responsibility in carrying Helen's legacy forward is actively remembering what she endured, so we can not only follow in her footsteps, but more importantly, do our bit to ensure that the horrors of history don't repeat themselves in our world today.
Do you, as we sort of come to an end now, Mrs. Lewis, do you have a message for the younger generations you'd like to give?
To appreciate all human beings as equal, and not to make any divisions on racial or religious or social grounds. All people, if they had the same opportunities, would be much more equal than they are now. And we all must strive to achieve a good standard for everybody, no matter how far away they live or how close.
The Streets Where They Lived is a Best of Belfast production, supported by the Belfast Buildings Trust and made possible by the Heritage Lottery Fund. Today's episode was written and edited by me, Matthew Thompson, and produced by Owen McFadden. To check out the stories of over 150 incredible people from Northern Ireland, including more heritage stories just like this one, please visit bestofbelfast.org. Thanks so much for listening, and look forward to catching you again next time.